Hello, and you're very welcome to Adapt Radio. My name is Dr. Claire O'Connell, and today we will be talking about AI and the need for a more civic internet.
From the Adapt Centre at Trinity College, this is Adapt Radio, presenting groundbreaking innovations one conversation at a time.
Now, those of us who remember the early days of the World Wide Web will recall the excitement of all that connection and information and that feeling of how it was going to change everything. And indeed, today, for many people, day-to-day life without the internet is almost inconceivable. But there are serious problems, things like mis- and disinformation, AI slop, and the unscrupulous gathering and selling of personal data. So is it time for a new civic digital domain on the internet? Today, we will hear about research being carried out through ADAPT by Dot Public and Trinity College Dublin, which looks at how public trust in expertise has been weakened by the commercial nature of the internet and how to enable a civic digital domain that protects people rather than exploits them. And I'm delighted to welcome three of the people working on this. Tony Aggie is Executive Director of Dot Public, and Tony is an Adjunct Assistant Professor at Trinity College Dublin. Jake Berger is Programme Director at Dot Public, and Professor Dave Lewis is a Professor in Computer Science at Trinity College Dublin. So Tony, Jake and Dave, you are all very welcome to the programme. So a civic domain for the internet, what is it? And how have we ended up in such a pickle where we need to develop such a thing?
I think it starts in two or three different places. I think the first is around information, disinformation, what can you trust, and so on. The commercial underpinnings of the internet, which are fantastic in every respect, kind of don't necessarily have a requirement for things to be factually correct. What they need is engagement. They need people to converse. They need people to join. They prefer it when there is a dispute, actually, because that gets more kind of attention and more engagement. And so for me, the issue is that although that's all fine and well, we still have a requirement for information that we can trust and experts that we can rely upon and organizations that we know will still be there tomorrow that are repositories of our memories. And unfortunately, the same internet, the same pipes, the same protocols, the same structures, the same platforms are carrying both. And it feels as if you imagine you have organizations, imagine you have a kind of a clean water problem where it's not even that it's kind of dirty or contaminated water. Let's just say it's fizzy pop. So, you know, fizzy pop would not do for washing your hair or washing your children or feeding your babies. You'd need to have a different source. But unfortunately, the organizations that produce clean filtered water are using exactly the same pipes and exactly the same bottles as the organizations with fizzy pop. And so as a result, it's impossible to tell which one you've got. And sometimes they're blended together. So, we feel that we need to have some way of, first of all, identifying the bottles that were filled by organizations with clean filtered water. This is a terrible metaphor. As well as it may well be that actually you just need a different reservoir where that reservoir uses a different kind of source and a different set of distribution channels. So that's broadly it. How do we create a world where the organizations who create important information on which we rely can be identified and that their information can be and their material can be kept separate from the other fascinating, interesting, exciting, but not necessarily useful stuff?
So it's about creating that environment where the person knows the provenance, I suppose, and maybe any agendas that might be there. I guess, is it like the difference between if you're in the high street, you go into a bookshop, you know that the bookshop is trying to sell you a book. But if you go into the library, you know the library isn't trying to sell you a book, yet they both have books. Is that kind of another metaphor you could think about?
Yeah, yes, it is. I think the public organizations, so organizations that were set up to serve the public, it was, you know, it, in the real world, it was quite clear what was going to happen to you when you walked into a hospital or a library, and that, you know, the doctors would ask you for the information that was relevant to treating you, either on the short term or on the long term, or the librarian might want to know your home address so they could send you a letter if your book was overdue. So it was kind of quite simple. It was transparent, and there was the sense that why would you bother gather more information than you need, and also why would you keep that information beyond the immediate purpose? None of those things are the case when these services moved to the internet. Usually not because the library decided to see what fonts you had installed on your computer, or to see which website you had visited before you went to the library, but because it was kind of sold as an easy, simple, unified solution to use, you know, the kind of commercial platforms to build in, you know, not just calling out Google, but Google Analytics, for example, or to not host your videos of a local book discussion, but to pop those onto YouTube, or to not promote your things by sending out an email, but by setting up a Facebook group. And by doing these things, all of which were kind of potentially a time savers and make it easier for that institution, because these services are often free at the point of use, that people just said, oh, well, we'll do that. And I look around, everybody else is doing that. Therefore, it must be okay. But as we're probably all aware of, the actual cumulative impact of all of those different services, all of those different products, each kind of sitting there, gathering bits of information, looking at things that are completely unnecessary for that service to be fulfilled, this builds up, and it, you know, it never gets deleted, right? Unless you actively ask for it to be deleted, which in itself can be quite a challenge to go through that process. That this builds up over time, and that enables people to have, you know, extreme levels of behavioral data, which can then be extrapolated into behavioral analysis, which can then be further extrapolated into behavioral prediction. And, you know, why do all these things matter? Because it enables Amazon to try and sell you a toaster because you have just bought a kettle. Now, that's a kind of reasonably harmless example, but where you might have a parent searching information about a medical condition that their child may have, that information is going to stick to that parent's profile, even if it's kind of done, you know, anonymously. There's still a huge amount of kind of triangulation that can be done so that an organization knows that this IP address or this kind of device fingerprint relates to this person who's asked about a condition about their child. It could probably work out who the child is. And then in 20 years' time, the child applies for an insurance policy before they go away, there's potentially that kind of data that would be available for the insurance company to decide to what extent they're allowed to have a policy or how it's priced.
Right. So this is a situation that has grown up because of a mismatch between the type of service that was being used. And I suppose we've all become a little bit inured to it. You know, probably that the parent who's looking up the child's medication is doing so because they want that information. They're not thinking about the long-term impact or the leakiness of the data. Dave, can I ask you, obviously AI has entered the chat in the last few years. How has AI exacerbated this problem of, I suppose, that this mismatch between the public good and the commercial system on the internet?
It's interesting in one sense because it's sort of making some of these trends more visible to people. Even while at the same time, you know, you could talk about, for example, sort of generative AI generating very plausible looking content. But I think because people are realizing it's plausible sounding or plausible looking, but not necessarily correct, or we're not really sure about the motivations of the people who are generating this. This is actually, I think, in a lot of people's minds, sort of sharpening their concerns about, well, you know, what can I really sort of trust on the internet, and what can I not trust? And there's broader, you know, societal impacts of that. That, you know, if everybody feels they can't trust anything, then it's difficult to have any reasoned discussions and debates on on important topics. But I think even in just people's day to day, you know, they're used to getting spam and ads, but now they're seeing, not always able to tell when it's AI generated, but they are seeing that happening. They're seeing volumes increasing all the time. So I think it is sort of filtering into the public perception. And actually, in one sense, I think it's bringing people's attention and making the debate about this a little bit more sharp. And people say, well, actually, there are things that we value. We do want to get information from trusted sources out to the public. There's a lot of, you know, governmental and civil society and civic-minded activities, for example, Wikipedia, that do things, you know, perhaps more on a non-profit basis or a governmental basis, who are having to struggle to make their case in a very sort of noisy media attention grabbing arena. And I think, you know, people are saying, well, this is having a negative effect. I think AI actually, you know, after a couple of years of us sort of fretting about it, you know, you can sort of see the debate saying, well, actually, you know, everybody's cottoning onto this and it's actually sharpening the debate. And I think a little bit the awareness that we need to be able to differentiate more clearly different sources of information, and that then brings up the question, say, well, what is it that characterizes something that we should be trusting against other things, which may be fine, you know, like we don't want to be cutting off people's sort of cat videos and things like that, but we want to, you know, the things that are important, things that perhaps have been produced by volunteers with the correct intentions, or with the sincere intentions, or, you know, done with public money, we want a way of being able to label that clearly so people can differentiate it. So it's about having a governance framework where we can make that clear. And you know, part of that is all saying, well, what's the sort of hard yards that people who are working to sort of civic values need to take on board? Perhaps some additional costs they need to take on board to be able to adhere to those standards. And what are those costs? And can we balance that against, you know, what effort and budget is available?
Just sort of relating that back to the searching for some medical advice example. I mean, you know, we're familiar even before AI started producing vast amounts of material. If you asked a specific question about a medical condition, the internet would have every possible answer that you could possibly imagine. Maybe you're looking for the one that supports your own worldview. Maybe you're looking for the one that makes you feel worst about that condition or makes you feel best about having that condition. But the ability of internet user to get a sense of to what extent is claim A backed up with some solid evidence. Is it coming from, you know, is it coming from the NHS, or is it coming from a university hospital study, or is it coming from some kind of quack who's ultimately trying to get you to buy their elephant dung pills, or is it just something from a kind of Reddit thread? Now, not to say that things on Reddit threads cannot be true, but it's helpful to know that this claim was made by a medical institution. Here are some references. Here's where the information comes from. Let's have a look at the underlying data. Having a sense of that kind of that transparency, that the provenance and the kind of accountability, so that you would have a route to potentially challenge that or to ask further questions.
Yeah, and indeed that you know that it's not somebody impersonating an institution as well, pretending to be the NHS or a big university or making up the references. So I suppose, Tony and Jake, you both have a lot of experience with big organizations that where you have been looking at how to curate and make accessible information for the public good. I'm thinking of, for instance, you've both been heavily involved with the BBC over the years. What kinds of trends have you been seeing? What kind of things have you identified as being important for keeping that information safe and accessible for the public good?
Well, what's that cliche about digital formats will last forever or 5 years, whichever comes first? So the kind of the sense that you've got to pay real attention to everything from how you create it, how you label it, how you store it, how it can be retrieved, and how you're kind of preserving it. I think a lot of those activities are peripheral still. They're not kind of seen as central to the core work of an organization. And I think some of that is because, if I'm really honest, although we imagine that libraries do that on purpose, they tend to do it by default. It's just, if you don't throw the book away, you've still got it. You know, with a digital file, if you don't throw it away, it will eventually deteriorate. So you don't have to keep refreshing a physical book to make sure that you've still got it where you do with a digital file. So this is a new kind of mindset we need to get into. And I don't think our organizations are quite there yet.
We see a similar thing in research, something like the Adapt Center has been running now for 12 years. We've run lots of different projects, perhaps with sort of European partners or industry partners. We might set up a website for those, but there needs to be an institutional commitment to keeping some of that information available. You don't necessarily always want to make all of it available forever, but you need to say, well, what's of good quality, what's important to future public debates. There's a sort of an archival or curating activity that needs to go in there, which is a sort of slightly slower, longer horizon activity than the usual sort of hurly-burly of doing research, where, we perhaps do execute a research grant over 1 year or 2 years or perhaps 3 years, but then go on to the next one, So the mechanics, the economics of being a civic-minded organization, doing things for the public good, having a lot of obligations to make this publicly available, but then, how do we actually make that persistent over time is still a bit of a challenge. There's a lot of discussion, some policy work, and big economies like the EU who fund a lot of this stuff in trying to make people attend to this. But I think it's similar to the general issue around .public, is you're trying to value the things that need attention over time in a sort of attention economy that cycling by the hour or the minute. So he says there's these different mindsets, and we need to perhaps be engaging not just in the exciting web hints or podcast hits and downloads. We need to say, how is this podcast going to last over time, and what would we do if some things we say on this prove not to be correct? Are we willing to say, oh yes, I was wrong then? And again, I think it's part of that standing by, taking responsibility for content that you put on the web, including admitting when you are wrong or updating it or making sure links to other new emerging bits of information are maintained.
Right. So putting resources into curating as well what you have over time. Can you tell me a little bit about the research that you've been doing at .public and Trinity through Adapt on issues around things like public trust in what people see on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a lot of, not just ours, but there are quite a lot of studies. Sense About Science have done some, and some on this side of the some on this side of the water. There is clearly, there's a decline in trust and respect for institutions, all the way from estate agents to politicians, and we've known that. I think the real problem area is that you're starting to see universities, public service broadcasters, doctors, even banks being kind of lumped in with that group. And so that, there was always a kind of a mistrust, not necessarily a mistrust, but it's always a healthy, suspicion. But I think the real problem is once trust goes, it's very, very difficult to get it back. I mean, the most obvious case in point is the BBC, which for generations was considered the high watermark, not just in the UK and Britain, but around the world. If you poll it now, it barely kind of compares to Fox News in certain parts of the world, which is terrible. I mean, how do you feel as a member of the public, that you feel any sense of a decline in trust for organizations yourself?
Do I? Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think I would probably, approach most things with a healthy skepticism anyway. But I think in the last few years, particularly as Dave, you were talking about, you know, how AI has maybe sharpened our senses a little bit about what we need to be on the lookout for things. And I still find myself sometimes a little bit sucked in by something until I go, oh no, something smells off here, you know. But you have to, if I were maybe not paying attention, that could be a big problem.
Think back to the kind of COVID situation. I know it's a while ago, but, you know, the way that the World Health Organization, you know, was considered, you know, a kind of an anti-information organization in certain parts of the world, where, you know, and other organizations or individuals were considered to be more knowledgeable than the World Health Organization. I mean, that's a real challenge, I think, for us.
I suppose in terms of how to address that, this notion of having a digital space or a digital domain where people can go and they know what they're seeing, they know that there's accountability, they know the provenance of the information, they know that it's the clean water as opposed to the fizzy pop. So tell me more about .public and that concept.
There are domains on the internet that are controlled, let's say in the UK, .ac.uk, right? So you have to be an academic institution, and you have to have some bona fides. You have to prove that, and that's not saying that just because you are, then everything's going to be fine and dandy. But you're going to know that various other actors and entities are not going to be within that space. That's reasonably clear. Same with things like .gov.uk, for example. That's a very clear sort of badging of what's going to be found there, and they have their own standards that are adhered to, such as around things like accessibility or around data processing. The .org domain, I think for many years people thought that was also happening there, but actually anyone can create a .org. But I think it still has that kind of that sense that it should be a respectable organization, and, you know, maybe a not-for-profit or a charity or something along those lines. But that is not the case. You know, that is not enforced. What we are thinking about with a new top-level domain is that if we are in control of that, then we are able to say what can happen there and what doesn't happen there. Now, this isn't just saying, you know, accept these terms and conditions and then go away and fill your boots and we'll never come back and check on you. What we would be doing is sort of front loading a whole bunch of checks that apply to, we have 9 standards at the moment. As many of those would be kind of machine readable and machine confirmable as possible. So they're kind of objective, binary, do you do this, do you not do this checks. And we would have various levels. So let's say level 1, level 2, level 3, and it gets increasingly harder to fulfill, to be in compliance with the standards as you move up those levels. So, you know, maybe Dave's personal food blog website, it would go for a level 1, but Trinity College Dublin would be looking for a level 3. And what we're doing at the moment in a sort of action engineering research is we are in a kind of iterative process of defining what those standards should be, understanding the ability of software, including AI, to be able to look at a website and say, okay, what's going on here? Is it passing accessibility checks to the highest level? Does it disclose its carbon usage or the carbon usage of the organization? Is there an appeals process? Is there a way to understand where statements and assertions have come from? Is it, you know, is it secure? Is it private? Is it interoperable in that, you know, if you wanted to take your data from one organization and move it into another, is that guaranteed? And so what we're doing at the moment is we're building tools and we're testing tools and then we're tweaking tools, but with the idea that we have as automatable as possible, a kind of one-stop shop where before you get one of our new top-level domains, your site has to pass the very basic level of tests. You then would get an accreditation. You'd then be able to get one of our domains. And it doesn't end there. So there would be ongoing scanning, ongoing checks as things change. Is it still compliant? You know, has a new software engineering team come in who didn't know that they weren't supposed to be using these things, and that pops up then. So the compliance, as I say, it's not a single check. It's an ongoing sort of living organic thing. And also, as you know, as the world continues to change, as it will, and technologies continue to change, what further checks would be necessary so that the sense of security and reliability and trustworthiness that you would have today would still be equivalent in 5 years' time, when probably 95% of the material on the internet is going to have been AI generated.
As Jake says, I think an organization, an entity that is has a .public website would be able to say very simply, we never spy on the people who use our services. We collect as little information about them as possible. We keep the information no longer than the service needs it. We'll be honest where the information comes from. And we make our services as usable by everybody, including people, you know, regardless of ability or disability. There's a kind of very simple check. You'd imagine any organization could meet those, but you'd be shocked at how many do spy, how many are not accessible. So.
How replicable are you making this, in that it would it be easy for organizations of any size, really? I mean, you mentioned there, Jake, the difference between Dave's food blog and an entire university. But is the idea that this is sort of a almost like a modular thing that no matter who you are, you can try and sign up for one of these. And if you pass muster, if you pass the test, you get the domain.
A lot of this work, it's not like we're you know, plow a completely new field. I think people have looked at this in certain areas, like accessibility for different sort of physical capabilities to a website, information you put on a website, perhaps declare your level of privacy or data protection, these sort of things. People have sort of looked at these, and I think, you know, the sort of work that's been going on at .public is looking a lot of these and packaging them up together. The AI one is really interesting because actually we're right in the middle of a lot of different bodies trying to react to that, to say, well, actually, how can we make those declarations? And even just at the beginning of this month, you know, August 26, you know, we had some EU transparency regulations about online content come into force. And they say some of the big AI companies are now having to and fro's about how well they're going to aiming to comply with that. I think a lot of this is trying to sort of bring together existing understandings, you know, because there is a lot there, but trying to put it together in a way that people say, well, we're packaging this so that we can make a statement about our adherence to these values as a whole. These are the things you can trust us on. This is how you validate them. Here's the checks. You know, the receipts are available.
We're not trying to make it difficult to do the right thing. Most of the time on the internet, it's easy. It's easier to play nice than it is to play nasty. And as we were saying before, with kind of institutions sleepwalking into using certain platforms and products because they thought it was going to be the simple thing to do. Often I think that's not the case. And particularly if you're building a new website or a new product from scratch, then, you know, not putting in a huge amount of kind of tracking material, making sure that your site is secure, making sure that your site is accessible, but doing that all from day one, rather than hacking something together and then having to try and fix it afterwards, we feel that it should be easier to create a compliant, a .public compliant service than to not. And actually, even if it is a bit more difficult in some cases, organizations need to sort of look at themselves in the mirror and say, what is it I'm actually here for? Am I here to provide information to the public in as clear a way as possible? Yes. Am I here to try and make sure that people come back to my site as often as possible and spend as long as possible looking at my videos or my social media content? I think there's very few true public serving institutions where that is actually a necessary objective.
for people today, in the absence of .public, which hopefully someday will be where people can go to get that sort of accredited information, well-governed information. But, you know, what can people do today in the uncivic domains of the internet to make sure that their data are not being used, or at least minimize the use of their data, or minimize their exposure to dis and misinformation?
Tony, you talked about when you were asked at a recent event, what can we do now? I think you had a good set of answers around that. If you're the head of a public facing organization and .public doesn't yet exist, what can I go into the office and tell my team to do or not do tomorrow?
Well, I think there's some very obvious things, like look at, you know, how you've set up Google Analytics, look at where you've, if you've got embedded Google fonts, if you've got the Facebook pixel. I mean, there'll be a number of, it's almost like homing devices that came with the kit when you built your site. What is usually the case, by the way, nobody ever does this stuff on purpose. Nobody's bad. It's just that, you know, the default setting is, like, if you look on your phone, the default setting is track me, please, and you have to turn it off. And so when people build a website, you know, they're using Wix or they're using anything that, you know, they pull off as a package, it comes with those helpful defaults. Also, you know, a lot of engineers today engineers want to work for the big companies, and the big companies, you know, this is their kind of customer practice. So they learn how to do that elsewhere, so that when they get to work at Google, they're ready to hit the ground running. Basically, find a way of scanning your own. So exactly as Dave said, there are many of these tools there. You can test for accessibility. There are tools that will let you do that. There are tools that will sweep you for cookies. There are tools that will check that will give you a sense of what kind of statements should you be publishing, and that you should be aware that you're making, and are you making them? You could look at your procurement rules. I mean, often the case with a procurement of a service, an upgrade to a service, a change of supplier, will be focused on price and efficiency, the whole kind of buy build thing, where it's always easier to buy it than build it, it says here. But often it's the case that, first of all, by the time you've had it customized to do the thing you want, you may as well have built the thing. Secondly, the ones that you buy always come with a huge number of other features and things that you didn't want in the first place. By the way, I think there was a point in the late 90s when there was no electronic device you could buy that didn't have a clock on it. You bought yourself and the reason was that the chip, the motherboard that everyone was using, by did the cheapest one, the one that you had a clock timer on it. And so it was easier to leave the clock on than to take the clock off. So sometimes, you know, it's about disabling things than it is about enabling things. But I think, you know, just ask that big question, like what is on our site today that is collecting data that we don't need? Secondly, what third parties have got a direct connection to us and our users, and do they need to be having the kind of level of extraction from our users as they do? I think those two simple questions. I think you turn a lot of things off, pay attention to a number of things, and turn a lot of things off, and things will be better tomorrow morning.
I think Tony makes a really good point with that link to procurement as well, because often we're talking about public bodies that go through public procurement processes, and often there's a bit of a disjoint between the goals of the organization overall and then what the guys in the procurement and the IT department are having to deal with, which is often driven by speed and cost. And I think it is about sort of understanding. So, well, you know, if you're saying, you could say, oh, we have a commitment, civic values and privacy and accessibility, that's great. But if you don't have an easy way for your IT guys and your procurement guys to test whether something you're considering buying adheres to those, then it's very easy to make the wrong decisions or not be attentive to. Yeah, exactly. So it's trying to make that sort of cycle of articulating the problem. You'll find the sort of overall values that we'd be talking about, you'd be hard pressed to find a public body that doesn't say something like that on their website already. Okay. It's the act of translating that, communicating that both to your, you know, to the people that you're buying your software off or not buying it. Often you're using perhaps free software, into them that's important and that's what we're looking for. And then also, because you've done that, you can then communicate that honestly with the receipts to the public who are coming to your website as well. So, you know, there's a whole chain that you have to connect together. It's a sort of, you know, it's a challenging management problem often in organizations that are worrying about budgets and timelines and things. So we're trying to sort of make that a bit easier, a bit more straightforward, and not make it such a big, complicated technical problem.
I was quickly going to say, you know, one of the procurement issue is a big one for me, because you've got a separation from the from one office, which is looking for the cheapest price and the fastest delivery, to the other, which is looking for the highest quality product and whatever. And in your procurement conditions, it won't be those safety features, important duration features, won't be there. They'll be cheapest price. So you often find yourself locked in to a provider, because they'll say, if you give us a 20-year contract, we'll give it to you at this price, whereas a renewing contract or whatever it is. So you've got that problem. The other one I was going to quickly say was the dreaded 80-20 thing. I don't know where on earth this thing came from, but that kind of notion that, this is an interesting observation, 80% of the something comes from 20% of the something, 80% of the value comes from 20% of the cost, or 80% of the usage comes from 20% of the features. The problem with a public serving organization is the 20%. Only 20% of the population have got a disability. Therefore, you can build a service that gets all of the, you know, the people without a disability everything they need. And, you know, the other 20% will cost a real effort. And what tends to happen is we think about that as if we're a commercial entity. I think, well, we don't need to worry about those low income, those low spending, those low traffic, those high attention people for now. Let's focus on the majority of people. Let's get them what they need, and we'll come back for the rest later. And often the case, you never come back for the rest.
So I think we could talk about this all day. Thank you so much to Tony Aggie, Jake Berger and Professor Dave Lewis for joining us today on ADAPT Radio to talk about this. And if you would like to find out more about this and more research being carried out through the ADAPT Centre, do visit www.adaptcentre.ie. For now, though, until the next time, from me, Dr. Claire O'Connell, Slán, and thanks for listening.
The ADAPT Radio podcast is brought to you by the ADAPT Centre at Trinity College Dublin. Find out more about their extensive research work at adaptcentre.ie. Join us next time to hear about more groundbreaking innovations. To get new episodes automatically, just click the follow button on your player right now. The ADAPT Radio podcast is produced by dustpod.io, with episodes monthly on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.